I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And welcome to Red Handed. Thank you very much to everyone who has reviewed us, as we've had even more 5 stars reviews. So we'd like to give a little shout out to our Laylee, who says that we are awesome. Thank you very much. That's very affirming.
And also, we'd like to say thank you very much to Sing It Back, who left us a 5-star review. Said that we moved the episodes along at the right pace and that we are now a no-brainer in that person's podcast lineup.
And a big thank you to Karen Alden, who said she just discovered us and it's a good mix of storytelling and comedy. It's a tough balance.
It is. But no, we really, really appreciate it. So thank you guys for continuing to take the time to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And today we have a totally unsolved mystery. And for reasons that will become clear, this case has never gone to trial. We're telling the story today of Dorian Corey, who was a drag superstar, pivotal to the evolution of the underground drag ball scene in Harlem in the 60s, 70s and 80s, and the first few years of the 90s. A little bit of a disclaimer, we will be referring to Dorian Corey using female pronouns because it's the right thing to do and we're not going to misgender people, that's not what we're about. Dorian was very much at the forefront of the really highly acclaimed 1991 documentary Paris is Burning, which was made by Jenny Livingston. I didn't know that she, I think this is right, she was a student when she made it. And it's this incredible feature documentary.
Wow.
Paris is Burning explores all of the pioneering drag balls of New York City. And Dorian Corey just comes across as the most regal, like almost a little bit retired, like, oh, these young children, I don't understand. Yeah, she really just comes across as someone who has been there and done it. My favorite quote from her ever is, "If you have on a label, it means you've got wealth." When it doesn't, really, because any shoplifter can get a label. There was a time when you could spend a great deal of time making outfits and preparing for something. Now they come very quickly and the moods change very quickly. But I come from the old school of big costumes, feathers and beads. And they don't have that anymore. Now it's all about designers. But it's not about what you create. It's about what you can acquire. If you haven't seen Paris is Burning, do yourself a favor and watch it. Because it's on YouTube. And not only is it heart-wrenching and, like, it's really informative. It really showed me how much of pop culture now stems from the drag queens of that era. Like, honestly, like, every single word that has ever come out of Tyra Banks's mouth, a drag queen said it first.
Don't know how to follow on from that. I'm just going to go straight to it. Oh, but Hannah's right. Paris is Burning is a fantastic documentary, but it isn't without its controversy. And it was attacked by African-American scholar Bell Hooks as being exploitative. And the immediate prospect of poor black men who want to be wealthy and famous white women suggests a sort of subculture of acute maladjustment. And Dorian had an esteemed career as a drag performer. She was and truly is a legend. Dorian gave her last performance on the 8th of May 1993 and died on the 23rd of August the same year from complications from the AIDS virus at the age of 56. When she died, the New York Times ran a picture of her in drag. It was the first time they had ever done this. This was a true testament to just how influential Dorian was in New York in the 1970s, 80s and the early 90s. This is really something for a person from such a marginalized community. I mean, she was black, she was gay, and she was a drag queen. Dorian was a true performer. She would lip sync, dance with a boa constrictor.
Hello, Britney. Like, this is what I mean. Like, anything that someone famous does now, I have a theory that a drag queen fucking did it first.
And she would also act as the mistress of ceremonies in clubs all over the states with her cabaret show The Pearl Review. She was most regularly a fixture of Sally's Club on Times Square. She coupled elegance, glamour, and a razor-sharp wit. Isn't that what we all want, Hannah?
Absolutely.
I would love it if somebody described me as elegant, glamorous, with razor-sharp wit. Maybe we need to appropriate some of this 1980s drag queen into our everyday personas.
Literally, that's all I'm trying to do.
And also, Corey was a headliner long before Paris was Burning. She was what people came to see. Dorian was loved by all who knew her. Many fellow drag queens noted that if you were ever in any trouble, she would take you in a heartbeat. But Dorian could also be very cruel behind people's backs.
Off stage, Dorian was absolutely not someone you wanted to mess with. Jesse Torres, who managed Sally's in the 90s, was a close friend of Dorian. Jesse said that Dorian lived in a hardcore neighborhood and had to take care of herself. And it is important to note here, like, I really don't feel like we can stress enough that being openly gay, let alone being a drag queen in New York at that time, was not safe at all. That's actually where the term realness comes from. Like, you'll hear, if you watch RuPaul's Drag Race, they say it all the time. Like serving executive realness. And it comes from, if you could get home from a ball dressed as a woman without getting beaten up, you were serving realness. It's like people don't question whether you're a man or a woman, like you're pulling it off. Paris is Burning illustrates that much more eloquently than I ever could. Because of this, not only was Doreen Corey a sensational performer and drag legend, she was a tough queen who could absolutely handle herself living in a rough fucking neighborhood. Doreen was born Fred Legg in Buffalo, New York, but moved to New York City and was in very infrequent touch with her family. But this is not incredibly unusual for the circles that Doreen ran in, so it wasn't seen as by anyone as particularly out of the ordinary. I think she wrote letters to her mum, but other than that, she didn't keep in touch. It was in Buffalo that Doreen started to do drag, and she moved to New York in the 50s to study art at Parsons School of Design. Doreen's apartment, where she lived for the last year of her life, was on West 140th Street in Harlem. It was small, but a treasure trove of her elaborate, intricate costumes that Doreen created herself and was famous for. One of her costumes was a cape that covered the entire room. Like, they really are just the most outlandish things that she would make herself. And she would sell them to other people as well. She would supplement her income doing that. So all of these costumes remained in her apartment after her death, along with the belongings of her boyfriend, who was called Leon, and Leon's brother, who lived with them for a bit. Think clutter and triple it. Like, I really get the impression that it's just brimming over. I think I read that someone was like, oh, you could lose a small child in there. And it really makes me think of, do you know about the Collier brothers?
I was thinking of Hoarders. Have you ever watched that
show? Well, that's what it's like. Like, the Collier brothers are like the original Hoarders. They also lived in Harlem in like the early 1900s. They had 14 grand pianos in their house and like a canoe and like all of this stuff. And they would dig tunnels through all of the stuff.
Oh, God.
And they would set traps for people. It's bonkers. Read about it. So that's what I imagine it like just tunnels of newspapers. What better place to find a Halloween costume? This is what two nameless straight men on the hunt for a cape of a vampire costume. So basic. This is what they thought. They went with Lois Taylor, a fellow drag queen who had been a dear friend of Doreen's while she was alive, on the hunt for a show-stopping Halloween drag extravaganza.
Now, Lois Taylor had been entrusted by Doreen Corey to sell all of her costumes, but what she couldn't sell, she had been instructed to just give away. After trawling through gown after gown and drawer after drawer, they just couldn't find what they were looking for. Nothing felt quite right until they saw a garment bag at the bottom of one of the wardrobes. This had to be it, right? The crowning glory, a garment so delicate and gorgeous that it had to be kept in a suit bag to protect it. I mean, you would be excited if this is what you stumbled across at this point. So Lois Taylor tried to pick up the bag, but found that it was far too heavy. This was not a surprise, though, considering one of Doreen's most famous costumes was a full Marie Antoinette affair, which I love, complete with guillotine.
Isn't that just amazing? Like, that puts any costume I've ever done to shame.
Brilliant. Taylor told one of these nameless straight men that she had brought with her to Doreen's apartment to cut open the bag, suspecting that it was one of Doreen's beaded gowns. It would have been heavy, but surely not that heavy. But nothing could prepare them for what they found inside. Inside this dusty garment bag was a mummified corpse, curled up in the fetal position, wrapped in plastic bags and fake leather, with a single bullet wound to the back of the head. I mean, can you even imagine? You go in for a fancy dress costume for Halloween and you come out with a dead body.
Ugh, I know. This is when one of our anonymous straight men revealed that he was a police officer and decided it was probably time to call the precinct. There is no statute of limitations on murder, so the investigation went ahead as if the body was discovered yesterday. The lead investigators on the case were Detectives John Rowe and Alfred Travers. And in all the interviews with them that we read, they're really just not very forthcoming, and they constantly are citing that it's an active investigation and they can't discuss anything in detail. The forensics expert, however, Raul Figueroa, loves it. Like, he'll talk about it for days because he was very proud of his work. He was also a licensed mortician and detective for the New York City Missing Persons Squad. They discovered that the body was that of a black male who was 5'10 and 140 pounds. He was wearing just blue and white boxer shorts. The body was purple when they found it, and the skin had shrunk, revealing a slight overbite, and the ears were nothing but spiky cartilage points. Figueroa explained that men are oftentimes much harder to identify than women because women usually have at least one strong attachment to someone, whereas men are much more likely to cut all ties. To make things even more difficult, hospitals don't tend to keep medical or dental records for more than 6 years. So, to identify the body, they were going to have to get creative. What Figueroa did was he cut the fingers of the corpse below the second joint in the hope of being able to identify the body using fingerprints, but he did run into some issues.
Maybe if you're eating at this point...
It's gross. It is really gross.
It might be an idea to just to stop eating or to come back to us once you've finished eating. Because the body that they found had been partially mummified. The plastic that it had been wrapped in had stopped any of the moisture escaping. So it had just sat in its own juices for decades. And the cleaning off all the muck was an absolutely painstaking process. They had to go so slowly and carefully because they didn't want to damage the body. As once the skin is gone, it's gone forever. Now Figueroa was working with secondary skin, a few layers deep, because the first few layers were totally lost due to what he described as slippage. It's similar to what you might lose if you had a really horrible sunburn.
He also said that when he's describing slippage in this interview, he's like, oh, he just talks about it in such a casual way. He's like, oh, you know, it's like when you pull a body out of the water that's been there for 3 days and the skin of the hands just comes off like gloves. That's slippage.
Oh my God. And also there was another issue with the body, which is even more gross. So microorganisms live on everybody's skin. And when you die, they start to eat through your skin, creating microscopic holes. And the body obviously can't regenerate as if you were alive.
So they're eating you all the time anyway, but when you're alive, you're just regenerating.
Regenerating, yeah, absolutely. So you can't regenerate it as if you were alive, meaning that fingerprinting ink would leak through the holes, making a usable fingerprint impossible. Figueroa managed it though. And he's really secretive about his technique. You can tell this is a man who takes a lot of pride. He holds this information back. But we read that he soaked the fingers in a solution to block the microscopic holes. But I don't know how sure we are about how credible that is. Because, well, it might give you a partial print, though.
Whatever he did, he had plugged the holes somehow.
Yeah. And definitely not the best situation, but you know, something for them to start with. I was actually reading something today about how you probably heard about this, about how ears are actually a much better identifier for people than fingerprints are.
I have read about that, yeah.
They're better identifiers because they were saying that if people work in tough jobs, you can form calluses over your fingerprints. They can disappear sometimes because of things like that. But your ears will always be like a perfect identifier for you. And they even said that even better than facial recognition software is ear recognition software, which is crazy. And they're genuinely working on this right now. My only issue with that as a crime scene, like ear prints, yeah, is like, why are you leaving your ear prints around a crime scene?
That's what I was going to say. Like, it seems very weird that like someone just touching their ear against the wall.
It's interesting though, but that they're working on ear recognition software. So,
well, maybe for, you know, missing persons like unidentified bodies, it would probably be really good.
I think that's what it is, like to see video and like do that rather than trying to do facial recognition. So either way though, back to the story. After he worked some kind of, you know, his mortician magic on these fingers and drying them out with acetone, he was able to get the prints from all 10 fingers, and they ran the prints and they got a hit.
Isn't that incredible that he got full prints from all 10 fingers of this body that has been in a wardrobe for God knows how long?
That is absolutely remarkable. You can tell why he wants to keep it slightly secretive.
So the man in the bag in the wardrobe was one Robert Wells, born in 1938 in North Carolina. He had a sister still living in North Carolina, and she told the police that his real name was actually Robert Worley, and everyone called him Bobby. Worley also had a brother living in Harlem, who informed the police that he had not seen his brother since 1968 when they lived together in the Bronx, and Robert Worley had just vanished. His sister said he just fell off the face of the earth. Robert used to drink vodka from the bottle, and it was an everyday thing, so he was known for public drunkenness. He fathered a child while he was living in the Bronx, but I don't think he was very involved. This is an example of Robert Worley not being particularly good news, in my opinion. His brother Fred had said that Robert had become attracted to a woman who lived nearby. When she refused his advances, Robert roughed up her 7-year-old child. That's so fucked up.
Oh my God, what an absolute piece of shit. You won't sleep with me, so I'm gonna rough up your child. Oh yeah, that'll do it. Now let's go. Yeah.
Exactly. Like in the interview, like the journalist really tries to press Fred for like, what do you mean by rough up? Like what actually happened? But he doesn't give anything away. So this lady, she threatened to call the police, didn't actually do it. But Robert Worley was never seen by his family again. So his family just assumed that he'd just gone on the run, just at the mention of the police. The only reason the Prince ran a match was because in 1963, Worley had been arrested of rape. And isn't it so weird to think that if he had no criminal past, they never would have identified him. His family would never have known what had happened to him, and he would just be this John Doe in a wardrobe.
Do you know what I find really weird? When people are like, oh, he's got dental, we found his teeth, you know, we found his head and it's got teeth in it. Let's do dental match. But if you don't know who the person is, how do you know who their dentist is? Is that, how do you, what? Like, how do dental records get matched?
That is a really good point.
Like,
I genuinely don't know.
Is there like a database where all of our teeth records get put onto?
Maybe, but maybe if the family is looking, like the family is going to know.
But no, you found a body and you have no idea who this body is, who the family is. And they'll be like, let's run the dental records. Where do they find these dental records to run against you? If you're listening and you do know that, then let us know, because that's weird.
Let us know about the National Teeth Database.
No, it's interesting because, like you said, the only reason they matched him was because he had a criminal record and they got his fingerprints. But like, I don't have a criminal record, but I have teeth and I have a dentist. But how would they know who my dentist was if they don't even know who I am? We're just like blowing our minds here now. Somebody tell us.
So what was Worley convicted of? He was convicted of, this is makes me so angry. He was convicted of abducting and having intercourse, and this is a quote, with a female, not his wife, against her will and without her consent. Forcing sex with your wife wasn't illegal at the time, and it wasn't even outlawed in the UK until 1990.
What the fuck? I mean, I knew that that was a thing that for a long time, obviously, in law it was that you couldn't possibly rape your wife. But 1990?
Yeah.
I was already born by that point. What the fuck? That is disgusting. That's absolutely outrageous.
And I just hate the wording of it as well. Like,
oh, yeah.
So, we've had sex with a woman. Oh, don't worry. It's not his wife.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you had sex with a woman. Oh, and it's not your wife, so we can press charges against it. And it was against her will and without her consent. Why? And again, this annoys me in so many things when we just don't use the word rape. When we talk about things and it will be like molested or sexually assaulted. Yes, of course, there's a difference between being assaulted and being raped penetratively. But like when children particularly, it happens to them. It's like in society, we can't bring ourselves to say what really happened. And we'll be like, that child was sexually abused. That child was molested. Why don't we just say what actually happened? That child was raped. We never say it.
It's so true. And this is another piece of like a piece of the puzzle of how black people were treated in it at this time, because on his court documents, his race is listed as C for coloured.
Ugh, I really hate that term. I'm not overly PC in any sense. I don't take offence. Like the other day we were at the pub and somebody described someone as black and then looked at me like, oh, and I was like, why are you stammering? Like to describe someone as black, it is not make you a racist. If you say that guy was black and I don't like those people, that's racist. There's a difference between being race-related and being racist. But coloured is such an offensive term. But what's worse than that is things like half-caste. Oh my God, what? That's such a horrendous word. I guess it's a sad indictment of the time, so.
In South Africa, coloured is the preferred term, apparently, for someone who's mixed race.
The thing is, though, it is just a word, and a word or a phrase only has the power that we give it, and it only has the acceptability that we also give it. So if the community as a whole feels like that's our preferred term, then that's the preferred term, because they haven't allied like sort of negative connotations towards it. But here I felt like if somebody called me coloured, it's already preconceived in my notions and in the wider community that that's a negative term. So it would make them seem ignorant. But if somebody called me a person of colour, it's just because we've accepted that that is the right phrase to use. Yeah. There is no right or wrong answer. It's only right or wrong within the context of the society in which you live and what has been determined to be acceptable by a certain community.
Yeah, like I have like South African friends and I was talking to them about it and it really made me uncomfortable. You're so right though, it's a cultural clash. So anyway, Worley was sentenced to 2 to 4 years in prison, and his brother said that he served almost the full term. I've also read that he was in prison for 3 years, so I think that's a good estimate. So he raped someone, and he got 3 years for it.
So Worley then had left North Carolina to escape a girlfriend who accused him of quote-unquote doing something to her. yeah, I think we can all use our imagination to guess what he did to her. And he was also involved in a number of petty crimes in North Carolina. Things like public drunkenness, theft, but nothing huge. He also fathered a child who he never met. Now, if Corey killed Wally 15 years before 1993, there would have been roughly about 25,000 unsolved homicides in New York City. If he was killed in 1968, which seems probably the most likely, there would have been around 40,000 unsolved homicides in New York City. So it's unsurprising that his disappearance remained unsolved until his body was identified in 1993. So how long had he been there? In truth, there's just no way of knowing. Figueroa, however, does have a theory. Inside the bag and the wrapping were like old school pull-off tabs from beer cans, which were most common in the US during the 1960s and 1970s. They literally look like tins of beans. Like, I think we've got some pictures we can put on Instagram. Now, Figueroa claimed that the discovery of this places the murder during the 60s or 70s, meaning that it was at least 20 years before the body was discovered.
I think it is most likely that Wally was murdered in 1968 when he went missing, but I'm just not sure how convinced I am by the beer can tab theory. Surely they could have been in the bag beforehand, they could have been dropped in later. Really don't think it's a definitive proof of time of death, but it was just basically the best they could do.
I know what you mean, because if they had been in there from the 1960s or 70s, the beers, he could have still been killed later and placed in a bag where they were already in there. But it is an interesting way to at least have a theory to start to narrow this down.
I can understand clutching at straws, because how long a person has been dead is normally determined by forensics by the rate of decomposition, and this was by no means a normal decomposition. It's extremely difficult, basically impossible, to get an exact date or even a year of death. Obviously, with a case like this, I think especially because it hasn't gone to trial, there are a lot of rumours and a lot of hearsay which we have sifted through for you, but there are three main theories of how that man ended up in a drag queen's cupboard.
So firstly, the first theory was that Dorian was trying to protect the real killer. So if we buy the beer pull tab dating system to figure out when this body might have been placed in there and therefore when he was probably killed, which we're not sure we necessarily agree with, but this would put the body having been there since the late 60s, early 70s. Dorian, she only moved into her 140th Street apartment where the body was found in the late 80s. Would she have dragged a body in a bag through busy Manhattan? That seems quite unlikely. So was the body already there when Dorian moved in? Did Dorian know the person who she took the apartment from and agreed to house this terrible secret? I think this is the least favourite of both of our theories.
Like, you have to accept two things. Either the body was there already, or someone, not necessarily Dorian, someone moved it.
If they're going to go with that dating system, it places the body being killed and placed there in the 60s, 70s, but Dorian wasn't there, so... But then, would you do that? I'd just be like, okay, I'm not going to tell anybody about your horrible secret, but get that fucking body out of here. Why would you just be like, yeah, leave it there and I'll cover for you?
My least favourite of the theories.
Yeah, me too. I'm not a fan of that theory, but it's important to cover, especially if we're going to go with that beer can dating. Now, theory number two was given by Chichi Valenti, who was a good friend and fellow drag queen of Dorian. She gave the theory that Wally had ended up in the suit bag because he had broken into Dorian's house, attempted to rob her, and she had shot him in self-defense. Chichi thought that Dorian had simply been too busy to get rid of the body because she was getting ready for the show.
I do quite like, obviously, like, murder's a horrible thing, like, that's not what I'm saying, but I do quite like this image of this gorgeous drag queen who shoots someone and is like, oh my God, I'm just going to have to deal with that later, I've got to go.
You know, he was caught for theft and things like that before, so it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that he had tried to break into her apartment and she had killed him. But he was shot in the back of the head.
That doesn't scream home invasion, does it?
And it doesn't scream self-defense. Like, mm-hmm. How are you shooting someone in the back of the head in self-defense? You shoot someone in the heart, you shoot someone in the head from front on. In the back of the head, that's execution style. The image in a very, like, cinematic sense of her being too busy to get rid of the body. But, like, I don't rate this theory. I don't think that this was self-defense. This seems execution style to me. And keeping the body feels like I just don't want to deal with this. I don't want to deal with this thing. I'm just going to hide it. I'm going to put it off. Like when you have, remember I was at uni, I've got these overdue library books. I'm just going to hide them under my bed because I know I need to get rid of them. It's a very different situation, obviously. But if she did this, she killed somebody and that's fucking horrible. But I don't feel like this is self-defense at this point. But let's carry on. Chi-Chi and many others were convinced that whatever had happened, though, Dorian must have been significantly provoked, saying that Dorian was not a violent person, but, excuse my expression, she was not to be fucked with. She grew up in a rough neighborhood, like we said before, she could handle herself. But what was she handling herself against, is the question here? Now, Livingston, who was the director of Paris's burning, was in shock also when the body was discovered. She remembered Dorian as an incredibly balanced person who was never out of control. And once while filming the documentary, a gun battle broke out in front of Dorian's apartment in 1987. Livingston said in an interview, "I don't know if she had a gun, but if I lived in that building, I would have had a gun." So, okay, I guess that's like a bit more credence to the fact that it was in a rough neighborhood. Breaking and entering, particularly, you know, armed breaking and entering, probably wasn't out of the ordinary. But still, I don't know, what do you think?
I'm with you on the back of the head doesn't, it doesn't make me think it's a crime of passion or a home invasion.
No, but we also talked about this, and I think it's an important thing to bring up because we talked about it before we were recording this fact. Well, fine, if it was self-defense, why didn't she just call the police? And you were absolutely right in what you said. Come on, could she be from a more marginalised community or more marginalised group?
This is a big issue with this case. It's like, because I can understand if something happened. So hypothetically, something has happened. She's killed this man because he was threatening her or he was abusive. She could not call the police. The gun probably wasn't licensed. They're just not going to help her.
No, I would agree. So I think had the gunshot wound to me seemed more like it was a self-defense wound or like a self-defense gunshot wound, I would be inclined to believe that that could have happened, but it is just the placement of it that really makes me think, is that self-defense? I can buy why she wouldn't have called the police. I can buy why she would have even just hidden the body in the back of her wardrobe and just been like, let me just move on with my life. But back of the head shot. How does that come about? Did Dorian even have a gun?
Dorian definitely did have a gun. Jesse Torres confirmed it. Dorian had been just about to go on stage one night and she handed Jesse her handbag and it was so heavy that Jesse was like, what the fuck have you got in here? And Dorian said, just a little 22, someone's gonna mess with me, I'm gonna shoot them up with lead. And apparently they had a running joke that the gun was so rusty it would never work. Because she was so well loved, all of the interviews you read with people that knew her, it's kind of, I have this hard time with a portrayal of almost unblemished innocence. Like, she was known to have a temper when she was drinking and, you know, nobody's perfect.
No, definitely. And I have a real issue with people giving anybody a totally unblemished aura of innocence. Like, I think, let's be real about it. Let's not idealize anybody. Let's not talk about any groups, any individuals like that. Everybody is deeply, deeply flawed. It does no one a service to talk about anybody as if they were perfect.
And like in Paris is Burning, she does seem very in control and almost resigned, but she was an actress. She was a performer.
Absolutely.
So that doesn't surprise me that everyone had this impression of her of being incredibly together when perhaps behind closed doors, maybe that wasn't the case.
No, definitely. And I'm also wondering, how is everybody saying, oh, she was so together, she was just no violence. She's making jokes, carrying a gun around, saying that if anyone's going to mess with me, I'm going to shoot them up with lead. Like, I would tell people that you're a together person, but if you said that to me, I'd stop saying that you were a together person.
Yeah, but I'm not a black drag queen living in Harlem.
I get that. It's all in context. But then let's be real about it. Let's not say she was an incredibly gentle soul and all this. Like, let's say it for what she was, exactly what she said about herself. If somebody messes with me, I'm going to fucking shoot them. That's what she said. So I think this idea of like, well, then let's paper over that and say that she couldn't possibly have done this unless it was self-defense. What is somebody's definition of messing with me?
Well, exactly.
Her friend was like, you know, she would never have done this unless she was provoked significantly. I wouldn't shoot somebody unless they were actually going to murder me. But what would it take for somebody else to do it?
I'm with Jenny Livingston on the sort of like, if I lived in that building, I would have had a gun.
No, I don't disagree with that. Quick point before, like back to the other theory about like home invasion or what could have possibly happened. Why was he just in his boxers?
So either that's how he was, which doesn't seem
breaking
like a home.
Breaking into someone's house.
Breaking into someone's house. Or it's possible that they were taken off the removed, taken somewhere else, and it was just his body in the bag. But I feel like if you're going to remove the clothes, why are you not taking his pants off as well? His underwear, sorry.
And also, why would you remove the clothes?
Yeah. I wonder whether, could they have rotted away? But no, I suppose the boxers would have done as well.
Clothes wouldn't rot away like that, no. That's quite weird, because that's okay. If we say the theory of the kind of home invasion, very unusual for somebody to break into your house in just their underwear. Secondly, okay, so why would you take his clothes off? That's getting very, like, up close and personal with a dead body. Like, if you've shot somebody in self-defense, there is no way I could ever go near that dead body, let alone strip his clothes off. Was he there as an invited person for things of a sexual nature? He starts to try to rough her up. She's like, are you messing with me? Shoots him in the head.
I can buy that. And this is where it gets really interesting. While Dorian was dying, she would call Jesse's drag mother, Sally, of Sally's on Times Square, whose health was also failing. Jesse would listen in on these calls at Sally's request. Dorian confessed to Sally that she had a secret. What was said word for word isn't 100% clear, but this is Jesse's account, and this is a direct quote. In Harlem, there are guys we would call takeoff artists. They would come around and just want to take from the queens the little bit you have. From what I'm told, this is the situation. He had robbed her before. He was known in the neighborhood as a junkie. If he knew you had a little bit of money, he would come around here, come around there with the attitude, fuck you, you're all faggots, fuck you, bitch. Seeing that society frowns on junkies, they feel like they could frown on us. He had taken things from her a couple of times and she was fed up with it. She was not having it. I feel like they definitely did know each other.
I feel like that could be a reasonable explanation. We know that he's a crook. We know that he's a thief. We know that he's violent. I wouldn't put this past him. Why was he in his boxers? That is the only thing. And I don't doubt that I reckon Dorian could have handled herself and got him down and shot him in the back of the head. I think that absolutely, if he was strung out, come round there, just with his attitude and his violence. But why is he in his boxers? Why did she take his clothes off? That's the thing that leaves it a bit weird for me. We do have to remember, though, with regards to the confession, that when Corey gave that, she was dying. She was suffering from the neurological impairment caused by her AIDS medication. And she was recalling an event that potentially happened 25 years ago.
Jesse Torres says when she was listening into these calls, she was talking to Sally and she's like, there's no way, like, that AZT has just fucked her brain up. She's just chatting nonsense. And then they find the fucking body 3 months later.
So again, I think everybody is looking at her through the best possible light, which of course you want to do, especially when somebody you love is suffering like that. But she did say it and they did find the body. So yes, obviously Jesse feels that way. But so were these phone calls a deathbed confession or just a product of a mind ravaged by AZT in its last days? Now, even if this is what happened, that Dorian had been robbed multiple times by a homophobic junkie and finally snapped, she was still a black drag queen with a cadaver in her closet. And it's like we said before, even if he had come round there and attacked her and she had shot him in self-defense, how much compassion do we think that she would have received from the police at this time in New York?
Absolutely none.
So I can understand why she wouldn't have followed up on this, wouldn't have admitted to what had happened. But it's clearly something that played on her mind for her to make a deathbed confession about it. There's a lot of gossip around this case, and gossip columnist John Livingston wrote at the time that a close friend of Dorian's told him that Dorian Corey had left a note saying, "This poor man broke into my home. He was trying to rob me." The column, however, cited that the body was found in a suitcase.
Yeah, so I don't buy, like, anything that John Livingston says in that column. I'm just like, well, you have the basic facts wrong, so I really don't think I believe anything you say.
If you want the same thing, basically, go read the Daily Mail. So I think whatever happened here, the one thing I will say that I feel like Dorian Corey did kill this man, and, you know, she played it right, though. Whatever the reason was, she left the body alone, she left it in that wardrobe, and she left it alone until she was not around to be arrested for this case. And I mean that purely in the sense that she played it right for herself. Killing somebody and hiding them in your wardrobe is not the right thing to do. Just in case anyone wants to write to me and say that I'm okay with people murdering them and putting them in their wardrobes as long as they don't get caught. I am not.
Thanks for that clarification, Saru. Do you know what? We have to be so careful. Like, So the third theory is that Dorian Corey and Robert Worley not only knew each other, but that they were lovers. The doorman of Dorian Corey's building told Edward Conlon, who wrote this an incredible essay on this case called The Drag Queen and the Mummy. So this doorman says to Edward Conlon, Robert Worley had been a lover of Dorian's and that he was a really shady guy. He came around all the time and he used to beat her up. And he'd been dead for 2 to 3 years. But then when Conlon said that the body has been in the wardrobe for potentially 3 times that length of time, the doorman didn't really seem shaken in his account and just sort of shrugged it off. So I don't really think it's the most credible story. But then also, obviously the doorman of your building is going to know more than anyone who's coming and going.
That completely makes sense. But that seems a big timeline to be wrong. He's been dead for 2 or 3 years, but that body had been in there for like at least, what, 25? Oh, I don't know. That doesn't make sense to me.
And Fred Worley, Robert's brother, was convinced that Robert was definitely in some kind of sexual relationship with Dorian. He told journalist Jeannie Russell Kassendorf, who wrote another essay called The Drag Queen Had a Mummy in Her Closet.
Good titles. All strong titles.
They're great, aren't they?
Like, the drag queen had a mummy in her closet.
I've been trying to think of like a play on words of like the skeleton in the closet. And then I read that and I was like, well, fuck, she beat me to it.
I was totally being sarcastic.
I think they're great titles. Oh, man. So Fred says that Robert had come home one night absolutely steaming drunk. And he actually thought that he was at his transvestite friend's house. I've put that in air quotes. I'm not using that word. So he was talking to his brother about this transvestite friend of his, and he kept mentioning the name Dorian. However, Pepa La Beja, who is my favourite drag queen of all time, just putting that out there.
I like that you have a favourite drag queen of all time. That's
girl, I am so into drag queens. Like, I love it. I love all of it. Pepa La Beja's also in Paris is Burning. So yeah, so Pepa La Beja, Chichi Valentini and Jesse Torres all maintained that Dorian never spoke about anyone called Robert or Bobby at any point. And they were very much part of the same group over those decades. Lois Taylor, however, claims that Dorian had written a short story about a transsexual woman with an abusive partner who kept pressuring her to have a sex change. And the story was very focused on revenge and murder. This one-page handwritten story, however, has never surfaced.
We have our own theory, though. Could Dorian possibly have been framed by her friend Lois Taylor, moving the body from 150th Street to 140th Street in the late 80s? Doesn't make a huge amount of sense. Leon, Dorian's boyfriend, who lived in the 140th Street apartment, had a dog that never smelt the body. I think we just find it really hard to believe that a dog wouldn't have found it, even if humans didn't.
I can buy that it's a small apartment full of loads of stuff, like it probably just smells a bit musty anyway. I can buy that a human would it. And also when they discovered the body, they said they couldn't smell it until they opened the bag because it was wrapped in plastic. But I just don't believe that a dog wouldn't have found it.
But maybe the dog, it's like if it's always been in there with the apartment, it's not triggering to a smell because it's just part of the background smell. I don't know. It is weird. I do agree that that is very strange. And also, it wasn't just the dog. Like, I know we said that humans can sell it. Like you just said, Pepa La Beja lived with Dorian in her old apartment on 150th Street and also never smelled it. Did Lois plant the body after Dorian died? She seems to be the only one with access to the apartment. And she spent a lot of time there selling Dorian's possessions after her death. And she was also very careful that someone else was the one to actually open the bag when it was discovered. And she was very careful to tell everyone that she couldn't lift it. Could this have been in an attempt to prove that she couldn't have moved it? That she couldn't have planted it?
In literally every interview with her, the first thing she says is, I only weigh 135 pounds. There was no way I could lift it. That's why we thought it was a really heavy gown.
Oh, but come on. We all know people that are like, oh, I only weigh 100 pounds. I can't possibly do this. Like, what's that got to do with anything? That seems very, I don't know, extra. What?
extra.
They're
drag queens. They are extra.
They are extra. But realistically, though, could she have even moved it? Or is she just keep saying I couldn't have moved it because she really couldn't lift it or have moved it?
Why it's important to note that, I think it's just because it's the first thing she says.
That is weird, but okay, whether we think it's like feasible or doable or not, why? Why would she frame her friend?
Because she's dead.
But why?
She's not going to get in trouble for it. She's dead.
No, but why? Where did she get this? So she killed this person and then framed her friend.
Like, it's just, I mean, it's just a theory.
Continuing with that theory, though, she must have killed that person about X number of years before, because even if we say when the body was found, 25, it was already dead for 25 years at least. She killed that person 25 years before. She's kept it safe somewhere all that time without getting caught. Why now take the huge risk of moving a body, potentially getting caught with it and hiding in Dorian's cupboard?
It's getting rid of it. It's the opportunity to get rid of it forever. If it's found in Dorian's apartment, she's dead. She's not going to get in trouble. She's not going to mind.
But she didn't get rid of it because then they open the wardrobe, find it, and then an investigation starts. That's the last thing I'd want, because even if I could say, oh, but you found it in Dorian's cupboard, I wouldn't feel confident enough that they wouldn't just trace it back to me somehow anyway. Who knows what you've left on there? That to me feels like you're opening a huge heap of, like, a huge hell of a can of worms and taking a massive risk. Firstly, you've got to get the body there, get it into the wardrobe, and then they've got to find it and not trace it back to you. Why wouldn't you just leave it alone? Because we said the perfect ploy that Dorian could have done as if she was the murderer was to hide the body in her wardrobe and leave it alone until she was dead. Why wouldn't that have worked for Lois Taylor?
After the, she didn't even look at the body when the body was found. In the interview, she's just like, and then I had nothing else to do with it. I just left. And when questioned by Kassendorf, Taylor responded, the boy's gone, right? She's gone, right? Nobody knows what happened but her and the boy. So if they want to find out, they better do a seance and have them come down and ask him. And Pepper LaBeija openly stated that she thought it was Lois Taylor and she didn't trust her as far as she could shove her. And I know this is me being biased, but like, if Pepper LaBeija doesn't trust her, I don't trust her. Also, the only person who knows about this short story, which suggests that Wally and Corey knew each other and were like lovers, the only person to have ever read it is Lois Taylor. And I think if she did frame Dorian, it is kind of the perfect crime. Like, if she, so let's say she has it in her own house, she moves it, and then it's pinned on Dorian and she totally gets away with it.
If that is what happened, and the way that it's transpired since, then it is the perfect crime. But it could have so easily have gone the other way. She could have left anything in there. The people working on this, by all accounts, seemed to be very good at what they were doing, the forensics experts, everyone. So all it would have taken was to find one piece of evidence that led it back to Lois Taylor. And then this would have been the opposite of a perfect crime. This would have been the stupidest fucking thing you could have done. If it's true and she's getting away with it and has got away with it, then it's the perfect crime. But it so easily could have not been.
Yeah, the problem remains, like, the only people who know what happened are dead. What are you most convinced by?
Firstly, I think that Dorian killed the man that was in the cupboard. Wally, she killed him. I don't know. There's between, were they in a relationship that was abusive, she had enough and she shot him and then hid the body in there, or it was a home invasion and she killed him. The reason I don't think it's a home invasion was because of being shot in the back of the head. But saying that, if he had done it multiple times and she was ready for him, she ambushes him, gets him down, shoots him in the back of the head. That could also be possible. It was just not in a, oh my God, you're in my house, I'm going to shoot you. That's not what happened. But the fact of the matter is, I think she did it, especially given her deathbed confession saying that she had this secret. I think it was her.
I think I, like, very reluctantly agree with you. Like, what I'm torn between is whether they just knew each other from, like, around and it was a robbery, or whether they were, like, together.
And the only thing that makes me think together was the fact that he was in his boxers.
My problem with it is the evidence to suggest that, apart from the boxers, is literally just a short story that no one's ever seen, and he got drunk one night and said the name Dorian at his brother's house.
That's quite a thing to do. And his own brother was like, I think he was in a relationship with her. I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that they were in a relationship, or at least engaging in some sort of, like, sexual acts, and he was abusive, because we already know that he's abusive towards women.
Why did nobody know about him then?
Good question.
That's the thing that doesn't totally convince me of that theory, is that literally nobody knows.
But wasn't she with Leon?
But she was with Leon when she died.
Oh, okay.
If she knew Robert Wally, it would have been in the 60s.
Oh, okay. Haven't we all dated the guy that you just hide from everybody because you're kind of like, he's a bit of a prick? Maybe that's what it was.
So if we're going to take this short story, like, if you're in a relationship with someone enough for them to be wanting you to have a full sex change, that's quite a significant person. That's not someone you're just screwing around with.
My thing is, with the short story, yes, it's a real shame that we can't see it, that it hasn't sort of surfaced, if it is true. But imagine if it was there and you could date it, that this was at the same time as when he died. Then I would feel like that was really convincing proof that he was an abusive partner. But without that evidence, without the short story, even if we believe those who said that they've read it, we don't know when it was written. It could have been written any time in her life, because any one of her partners could have said that thing, said that to her. So we don't even know that that abusive partner was Robert Worley. So yeah, it's really hard to say. And I think this case will have to remain a mystery, sadly, unless anything else surfaces. But from my point of view, I think, yes, Dorian killed him. But under what circumstances, I can't say.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. Like, please let us know what you think.
What you think. Excellent. Thanks very much for listening, guys. You know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe. Leave us some more five-star reviews, maybe?
Yeah, and follow us on all of the things at Red Handed the Pod.
Thanks. See you next time.
See you later. Bye.
Bye.